KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You may know my guest, Rose McGowan, from her work on screen, certainly in the Planet Terror and the other films of the Grindhouse collaboration. I think that she's done a short, the short is called Dawn, that reminded me it could be sort of the companion piece from the first thing I saw her in, the sort of the post-punk noir, the Doom Generation. It kind of connects to that. It's a short that... Well, I'll let Rose talk about it. First of all, Rose, it's a thrill to have you here. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Elvis.
They could be companion pieces because they could both be, for their era, kind of almost urban legends, you know?
You're actually a cautionary tales, whatever you want to put it as, you know, completely. That's interesting. I actually hadn't thought of that, Elvis. It's, Doom Generation is punk and in your face and all this stuff. And for me, I'm really interested in exploring like the subtle terrors and our subtle horrors. And I set out to make a film. It just happens to be 18 minutes long. Hemingway is one of my favorite authors, and I believe in editing, and I believe in tightening things. And sometimes it could have been a full feature movie, but did it need to be?
In fact, I thought about that as I was watching the short, because I met you when I was doing an interview with you talking about production design, about which you're quite expert.
About which I am quite expert. I've restored four houses of different periods. I have seven storage facilities that are filled with collector's pieces that I actually don't know what to do with now. And they've become a bit of an albatross. But they're so beautiful, I don't know what to eat. I have Ava Gardner's furniture set, her bedroom set from when she was with Frank. At one point, I have the Vanderbilt Estate 1930s Art Deco sink. I have the original RKO letters in my house. New York Times did a piece on them, actually, too, which is very cool.
Yes,
there are some of my Orson Welles' tie and tie pin, Dietrich's Courage travel suit. I have a lot of Barbara Stanwyck stuff, a lot of Preston Sturges, and I collect first edition books as well.
Were you the same size as Barbara Stanwyck?
I was. Was.
The same size as
Close.
She was.
The same size as she was, yes.
Okay. I thought you might have been.
And when we met for the New York Times piece, it was... one of the highlights, you know, of I've done so much press and been on so many covers and yada yada, but that piece and meeting you was, you know, my first, probably my favorite interview, Elvis.
Okay, thank God you can't see blushing on the radio. Anyway, let's talk about Dawn, which is the short that you've directed, which has debuted at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. And you're very deliberate about setting tone. I mean, it starts with a flash forward, which is kind of tense, but then you give it a lot of breathing room afterwards. And talk about what the piece is about.
Dawn is set in 1961, and I wanted to study what would happen when society and maternal influences set about on making a young girl a lamb, basically for the slaughter, and then what happens when she does, in fact, meet somebody who's a sociopath. What happens when you strip a girl of every defense she has? And her defenses usually aren't that many. And now you've isolated her. And now you've literally programmed her. You know, the two men she cites as, you know, like just men that she cites. She reads a Tab Hunter interview in the piece, and it's a real interview. And in the piece, she's trying to learn how she should act on this date.
I was going to ask you if it's a real, that was taken from a real piece.
It's taken from a real piece. And the interview, so she's reading it on her bed, and it says, you know, she's trying to figure out how she should behave on her date that night, or, you know, he's coming over. And he's like, I like girls that ask questions and are curious, but not too many questions.
Not too pushy.
Not too pushy and not too many questions. And she's like, not too many questions. She repeats it to herself. And those kind of subtle things, you know, and I'm doing this all in 18 minutes. I actually don't like short films, really. They're not my favorite.
Because?
I've just never attached to them. I don't know. I've seen some that are outstanding, and I've seen a lot that aren't. I haven't seen that many. I don't study them. It's not my thing. I studied film, you know, empirically, but that's what I studied with my father since I was four. He was a complete cinephile, and I grew up with that. And plus, it was kind of one of those things where you get a hold of shorts. You know, I'm not at a festival going to see shorts. So they actually don't happen in people's lives that often. So Dawn, I have this amazing actress, Tara Barr, and what I wanted to
How did you find her?
a great casting director. My criteria was nobody who would be on the CW. Now, as full disclosure, I was stuck on the CW. So I am definitely putting myself in that. Even though I was an oddball on that network, I never fit in.
This one of these physician heal thyself kind of situations?
Well, it was... Anyway, believe me, I knew what I was talking about.
Was it a full feature script or was it always
a
short?
No, I was originally doing a Flannery O'Connor short. I was doing A Good Man Is Hard to Find, and I lost the rights at the last minute. I left the fourth location with the big producer and blah, 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 and I was mortified. I get a call from the foundation, and they sold it to a rival company for the company that was producing Dawn to make into a feature. And I, frankly, if Flannery O'Connor wanted to make something full length, she would have made it full length. I don't think you should ever mess with her writing. Just leave it. The only movie I do want to remake, well, there's two, and I won't. Well, one I might, but one, I would never remake Repulsion because it's flawless, but I would love to.
Okay.
I would love to do a spin on that. And then the other one is Wise Blood, and I might.
Well, it's interesting because you can sort of see certainly hints of Polanski in this, just in the way that you build the dread so slowly.
Oh, you think?
Well, you clearly, it's about that and that sort of that sense of claustrophobia of her in the car.
I was I wanted the emotion of, and it's very different, you know, tonally, obviously, than Night of the Hunter. But for me, there's a sense when Robert Mitchum is hunting the little kids and there's that sense of dread that this impending, you know, these storylines are going to clash. You know, these two characters are going to be together in the dread that you feel. So for me, Dawn was kind of a study of loneliness in some ways. You know, I wanted it to kind of have the loneliness of an Edward Hopper painting. And I wanted it to have the stress of Night of the Hunter. And I wanted it to have the look of the original Parent Trap. I cribbed her bedroom completely, the production design from the California section of the Parent Trap, and my homage, complete with a stuffed animal that she had on the bed. Same thing.
By the way, it's the treatment. I'm talking to Rose McGowan, an actress you know her as, but she's directed her first film, a short called Dawn, and it's about what looks like star-crossed love and is not. And I love, too, that you use Young Love, which, by the way, you know, Tab Hunter did a cover version of that song.
I know. It's in the movie. plays in the movie.
I mean that's one of the – I love that that song has so many iterations by so many people who covered it weirdly all in exactly the same way.
There was no – they did Young Love. I mean, Sweet Love. I mean, and these were the people that were singing to teenagers. It's so cute. Bless.
But that he would have done it basically the same way the original version was done. You go, wait a second now. But almost every cover of that song is basically almost like people were hypnotized by the rhythms of it. And that almost sets into motion that kind of hypnotic effect.
It is really hypnotic. You're right.
Well, and I think that's the kind of a mesmerization that goes on that takes place for Dawn, who really, she lives in a repressive household. I mean, we see at the beginning, she's really trapped in the car with her parents, more to the point with her mother.
And the dad's just checked out.
Yeah, and so when she sees a guy at the filling station,
you have to be careful when people use, and you know, I study a lot of period films, and when people, she's looking at a magazine, like a photo play kind of magazine, and Tab Hunter's on the cover, and he asks her, he's like, do you like pictures? She's like, I love pictures. But you would say pictures instead of movies, and you would say filling station in front of gas station. And these are all details, and I'm very, very detail-oriented, and as are the writers. The writers are brilliant.
Well, how much shaping did you help the writers do? How much it was them, and how much did you bring to the script yourself?
You know, after losing the Flannery piece, that was the tone that I wanted. And they know me very well. I've been friends with one of the writers since I was 13. I mean, it's all so weird. I was skipping school in Seattle, Washington, when I was 14, to make enough money to go to my little gay nightclub and dance on the weekends. And so this kid was an actor in Near Dark, the writer. He was an actor in Near Dark. He was the young vampire in that, and Joshua Miller. And
he was in
River's Edge.
Yes.
His father was Jason Miller, who was in the priest in The Exorcist, wrote a championship season. And he and his partner, Mark Fortin, M.A. Fortin, are these two brilliant writers. They just sold a huge screenplay to Warner's for like a 1930s movie. Like, oh, they're tremendous people. And they just looked at me and they said, it's time. It's time. They knew how trapped I had felt, and I had ultimately left, with the exception of a couple things. I did jobs. I was like, oh, I need health care, and I happen to be in L.A. Sweet, I'll do this. But for the last 7 years, by and large, I've just traveled, and I left. And it was actually promoting Grindhouse that was a tipping point for me, that I just was done. I was done.
So you were saying before we started that you just felt you were done with acting, and this happened to come your way at a time you were done with acting, right?
dovetail nicely.
But
I think when you actually really define what you want and what you are as an artist, you know, the thing is I'd gotten lost, so lost in the machine. I didn't play well with the machine. I didn't understand it, and it didn't understand me. Always pretty much square peg, round hole by agents, managers, people who didn't really, you know, put it this way. They always wanted to get me in Us Weekly fashion pages. If I'm in Us Weekly fashion pages, I've done something wrong. I don't want to be heralded, you know, in Ohio. But the thing is that really, the reality is you forget, you know, when you're an actor and like me, standing on the street corner getting discovered, and then within two years, I'm internationally famous, and you just get lost. And I never had the chance to develop. I knew I was an artist, and I was just trapped in other people's sometimes not very artful projects, which is a particular kind of hell. You know, it was very claustrophobic for my soul. I grew up as a gypsy. I grew up in Italy and moved all over the world, and very itinerant nature. And it was very difficult for me to be locked down with schedules and contracts. Like locked into contracts were for years. You could literally not do this, not do that. You can't. It was so ordered and just not. Like I did a TV show that could have been so much more. It was about young women, and they did nothing with their voices really.
And young women finding their power in unconventional means.
Right, and that's what we were doing, and they could have explored so much more, I found, with that. And so to be a frustrated artist and not always think it, believe me, I was on sets where I couldn't have done it better, go for it, or it just wasn't my taste or whatever it was, but this person was killing it. Great, but I worked on a lot, you know, where it wasn't artful and these people weren't approaching it as art. And I was raised by artists. My father was an amazing artist. My husband is an artist. And to be around them and to feel like you're not around people that value that in any way is it's hard on the soul. You know, so I took about 7 years just to disconnect, really. And I had a series of unfortunate life events. And I think it's just what it took to snap me out of it, to get me out of it.
This spur to start directing and this project, interestingly, too.
I've directed for years. I've just done it in my head on other people's sets.
I'm sorry. This decision to literally take the reins as compared to doing it in your head.
Which gets you far.
Clearly, it's done okay for you.
Actually, I've done okay. Yeah.
But this project, interestingly, is about somebody who's stuck, who's trapped inside somebody else's life. And clearly, it's metaphor for your own career's own level, isn't it?
Well, not only, I mean, it gets pretty meta. Not only was I trapped in other people's lives, I was trapped playing other people that I wouldn't even want to be. And I didn't understand because I was so uncomfortable in my life. It all felt uncomfortable. And I'm actually very good at acting, and parts of it I really love, the disappearing. But for me now in my life, if I'm going to disappear for 15 hours a day into another person's brain, mind, soul, heart, they better be worth it.
I mean, because I couldn't help but think in that sequence, I'm glad we're talking about this, where she's being sort of commanded to do certain things and being brutalized both verbally and physically, that felt like it could be a movie set gone wrong in some ways.
I've had those sets. You know that.
Yeah.
I had a lot of, I don't know if it's bad luck or what. I know some people have had very different experiences than I have. I've had a tough time with the misogyny, a really tough time with the abuse. And I don't know if it's something, you know, I've had people say, and it was my whole life, not just, you know, in Hollywood. Just sometimes people just want to break certain people. They seem free to them, and that offends them on some level. And I just don't feel like, you know, and they never did. I just disappeared because I didn't want to deal with her trying to break me. But the reality is that it's not even anything that would be allowed to happen anymore in my life. There's no place for somebody being cruel to me. There's no place for me saying, sure, I'll do your film and you're allowed to abuse me or hit me with your camera or drop or just be vicious. You know, there's, and I, as a director and as somebody who's been on, I've estimated, conservatively, I've spent over 17,000 hours on sets. That's a conservative estimate. There are very few people that can touch that. Directors, actors, anybody. So when people are like, what's it like to be behind the camera? I'm like, oh, babe, I've been behind the camera, on top of the camera, on the sides of the camera. I've been around the camera my whole adult life. Literally, I grew up being different people. That's how I figured out to grow up and come into your own as an adult while being different people. So the only time you're you is when you're home and have to learn the 10 pages for the next day is a particular kind of weirdness.
We'll take a break. My guest was.
I think I'm going to go running screaming through the streets now, Elvis.
No, don't do that. Stick around here. My guest was finally had the director in her head break through and emerge into a film set is Rose McGowan. Her directorial debut is the short Dawn. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. My guest who thinks she can be corralled is Rose McGowan. You know, as an actress, she's now a director, making her debut with the short Dawn. But again, I guess I just found it's so much about the way pop culture weaves its spell on us, right? And to the extent of putting her in a pop culture cocoon, that scene in the context of another movie was kind of ideal. But here, it's a prison. You use the word meta in the first half, but you like playing with the way people perceive things versus the way things actually are.
I like disrupting the mind. And I see things, and I've studied things, and I see the true, you know, intentions underneath people's words. And this is what I've done as an actor. I've studied people's behavior and their mannerisms and societal themes and gender politics and all these things I've watched on the sidelines. I've been watching for years. And now it comes into play. I always said, you know, oh, useless talent number 75. I had all these things that I was really, really good at that I had no outlet for. You know what I mean?
Like what were you
like
thinking?
Design, like filmmaking, like this, like that. I had all these things that I knew I was really quite good at and had mastered in my own life. But I always joke that they're all things I'm very good at that make me no money. But now I can actually – and although it still has not technically made me any money, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's, you know, being at Sundance as a director is wildly different than being there as an actor.
What was that like? Contrast those experiences.
Well, one, getting in and being nominated for the Schwartz Grand Jury Prize, I almost passed out. That was amazing. That was truly, I felt my knees kind of go a little weak when I found that out. And they had over, this year's like record submissions, and it was very, very difficult. You know, they had over 8,300 submissions, and 12 got into my category.
What was your first day like as a director on the set? What was the first feeling like?
I kept waiting for panic to strike, and it never did. There was not a moment where I was nervous. There was not a moment where I didn't feel like I was the captain of a ship. Because I've always been kind of the de facto leader of the crew, usually because sometimes I'd work with actors that were, like, mortify me, and their behavior in front of a crew would, who were always my friends, would hurt me. And I would try to be the anti-actor. And I'm like, I'm not like that. See? And I would try to be the anti-person on set. Like, very, like, I get along with everybody. But I was always, you know, the leader. And it is hard. You know, somebody say, we need a C-stand. I'll go grab the C-stand and deliver it because I can do it faster and better. And for me, on days that I wasn't working as an actor, I would go hang out with the production designers. I would go hang out with the art department. I would work and learn how to load cameras. I would do all the stuff that actually interested me was being on a set. The intricacies of being on a set, the sounds of being on a set. I shot at Paramount for a long time, which was the best part of being on that show. And being under the rafters that have seen so much on those stages, I mean, to know that you're part of history and time is a pretty special thing.
And tell me about, because you talked about casting your lead, but finding the other actors too, because I found myself staring at the woman who plays the mom.
She's fantastic. Yeah. She was the mother was the hardest role to cast because people were coming in and playing it really, really broad. And what I wanted her to look like, of course, was the Columbia Pictures woman, you know, which would be what? Was that Deborah Carr? Yeah. So I kind of wanted that crossed with this thin line that she gets in her mouth. What was interesting to me was how, and it was interesting to me as an actor, you know, times I've had to go in and audition, you'll see somebody in the room and you think, oh my God, they're it, they're perfect. And then you go home and you watch the tape and it's completely somebody else that you hadn't even paid that much attention to.
Really?
Not as much attention to. You were like, they're good, but this other person really, they really rocked it. Then you watch the tape and you go home and you see the subtleties, the slight movement of the eyes, this, and you think, oh. So I met them all, of course, because I hate being put on tape with a director like is too busy to go meet. I just like, how could you even want somebody in your film that you don't know? That's bizarre to me. That's a bizarre way of casting. I wouldn't know if I wanted to even be around you, if you know, let alone have you make me so vulnerable that you're starring in my movie. You're going to be a an A-plus person and a good worker. And they were, and they're tremendous. And they really had tough roles. You know, the young guy, I wanted somebody who'd swung a pickaxe. You know, back in the day, you could shake a tree and a Gary Cooper would fall out. But I find that there is a dearth of men in Hollywood. And when I mean by men, I mean men. Like the Robert Mitchums, the people like this. And I think that's because so many actors that we have today, particularly American males, they've grown up, you know, as child actors. These people have never had a hard job in their life. They have soft hands. And I'm not, and I'll be damned if I'm going to play somebody who's got a rough life and, you know, just by the difference, he works at the filling station and Don's parents are in a brand new car rolling in. You're setting up the socioeconomic difference in between the two classes there without having to say anything. And I wanted somebody that looked like he would have had a job in his life. You know, why do you think we import so many big screen stars that are playing the masculine roles from other countries?
I thought that was interesting, too, because even when they go
out. But he needed to be soft and sweet and gentle and pretty enough that he would lull her into the, because little girls like things that aren't quite scary, but he's just at 10%.
Yeah. I mean, he looks like a guy.
I wanted a young John Wayne.
But you dress him like working class. Even though I was noticing the date, you use the costuming very specifically. I mean, you know, there's the work jacket and the flannel shirt that haven't been chosen to match the way they are in movies. They look like the kind of thing somebody would wear after he got off a job.
Correct.
And you were very specific about that. And also the way that her friend, the girl who accompanies her dress doesn't quite fit. So, I mean, it's very interesting how you were playing on.
I took everything I could play with, every theme I could explore, and everything I had, which is, for me, a tree is a character in the movie that I'm going to make. A tree is a character. And the environment is a character. The clothing says so much. You can say so much. Because I've been on so many movies where they've not said as much as could be said with my character or other characters around me or their film. By not paying attention to details, by not realizing, like, you know, a lot of times when you see period pieces, everybody has a brand new car. Like, that doesn't happen.
Or brand
new
clothes.
So the kids had a brand new clothes. They're, like, shiny and new, like, a non-scuff. That wouldn't happen. You know, the kids' car in the movie is 9 years older, and it's the kids', like, parents' car. So it's, like, 9 years older than Don's parents' car. And just obviously by their decor and this and that in their house, it just sets the world correctly. It just helps you say what you want to say. And when people don't make full use of that, it kind of drives, it's a little frustrating.
My guest, who's finally taken the chance to say what she wants to say as a director, and certainly on the show, is Rose McGowan. Again, her first film as director is The Short Dawn. It's The Treatment. I guess I'm wondering, too, when you chose the actors, how did you explain the characters to them? Because almost everybody, with the exception of Don, everybody we meet seems to be one person and becomes somebody else.
I said, you're a gang of pedophiles. And one of you is against it. But the guy, my primary direction to him was, you're a pedophile. Not in the age sense, because he's young, as is she. But I said, in the way that they disrupt the mind of their victims. You're lonely, huh? You're beautiful, you're this, you're that, you're that. I mean, all done more subtly. Your mom doesn't listen to you. They're being seen by this person when nobody else sees them. They're being paid attention to and they're invisible to everybody else. And that then combined with, you know, societal and maternal conditioning to be essentially perfect and cause no fuss and be very apologetic for existing, it sets up, you know, a big crash.
And
we still do that.
No, but what I was going to say is it's interesting because the young actress who plays her friend seems to be the more confident one. We find out, in fact, that she's just as much under the thrall of this misogyny as is Dawn, which okay. I thought was a pretty interesting thing to work out.
Yeah.
And how'd you find how'd you find the rest of the cast? I mean, you were talking about that too.
Same great casting directors who I would use again, and they're pretty offbeat people, and knew that I didn't. I just know very specifically. I saw a lot of people, but I know very specifically what I want. And I've been miscast in things, and I've had people working with me as actors that were miscast. And casting is a huge component, and so many people make a mistake of casting people just to get the money, to get the movie made, and this and that, and then the movie doesn't turn out well, and you're like, well, you cast it badly because you were so intent on getting it made. Just wait a little longer. and fight a little harder and do the right thing. And then you can really have something that sings, you know?
And you had the time to cast it, right? And did you get rehearsal time with your actors as well?
Only one day.
Yeah?
Only one day. And within 2 months after the script, I was shooting it. So it wasn't like, but the pre-production was really, really solid. Pre-production is really important. People skimp on that a lot. If there's anybody out there who's a filmmaker or going into this aspect of it, I would say do not skimp on pre-production.
Is that something you learned from just all the work you've done that people, when they tend to err, it's on the side of pre-production?
Yes. And post, of course, but pre is really, really important.
And then in the cutting, because as you say, there's one thing to shoot it and it's something else to start looking at and doing the post and thinking, well, or realizing what you do have as compared to what the movie you thought you made in your head, and then being confronted with the reality of what you shot.
I think it's actually that you have the movie in your head to an extent, and then you create the movie that you had in your head in editing.
And were you able to do that pretty much the way you wanted?
Primarily, yes. There's like two moments that I, of course, I'm like, ugh, I cringe when I see them, but they're tiny moments.
We were talking about seeing it at Sundance, and what was your reaction the last time it showed at Sundance, where it's played a few days in a row now? Was it still as magical for you then?
Yeah, it really was. And they took it to Sundance London, which they're doing now, which is huge. It was at the O2 Arena, which is where they did, you know, the whole thing for the Olympics. So I got to see it on a 70-millimeter dome theater. That was intense and beautiful and such a treat, state-of-the-art. So the color timing was right. You know, the color pitch of it was correct. And because the color for me plays such a big role in it, the palette of the movie plays such a big part. But as a director, as I've learned, which is horrible, you have to learn to deal with the fact that every time it goes in a different theater, the color looks totally different. The sound is different.
Well, that's one of the things I would say. Like,
it's painful.
Speaking of the
sound. I've had directors say you just need to let that go. It is hard.
You got to let that go. But speaking of the sound, when she's playing music at home, we hear it through an old mono record player and not the kind of stereo that people usually use in movies. I mean, you were very specific about trying to keep it as close to the period as possible, weren't you?
Well, it just was the period. I just wanted to create a world.
But you know what I mean.
I totally know what you mean, and I agree. I'm very detail-oriented, and the devil is in the details, as they say. And that's true. All these little tiny details add up to a sum total. And if you can just, as a director, really think, like, about each, like, area of the set. I was dragging all the couches around myself and doing it, of course, you know, because that's what I do in my houses, and that's what I do for, I've helped design other people's houses. My father restored craftsmen's. Not professionally, he was an artist, but that was his thing. And so I grew up, you know, going to Falling Waters for our family field trips, or, you know, I had a very intellectual, wackadoodle, eccentric, wonderful, horrid family on every level, and they trained me to be an artist and to see as an artist. And that's all coming into play now, and it's been great.
Well, it's great having you. We're out of time.
Thank
Rose,
you.
Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Elvis. You're the best. I adore you.
No, you're the best.
Always have.
My guest,
you are.
My guest is Rose McGowan. Her first film as a director is The Short Dawn. Our recording engineer who also mixes the show is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm not a Virgo. I'm a pancreas, as the old jokes goes. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.